all geographers, it's a matter of how detailed you want to be. If you want to be just real indifferent, this is the one you'd use. South Texas, coastal plains, northern prairies and plains, Edwards Plateau, mountain and basin region, high plains. Anything wrong with that? No, that's totally accurate. And if that's the minimum amount you learn, so be it. However, we can get a little more explicit. The Panhandle Plains, the prairies and lakes, the Piney Woods, the Gulf Coast Prairie, the South Texas Plains, the Hill Country, also Edwards Plateau, and the Mountain and Basin, and the Big Bend region. Now, if you want to go overkill, and this is overkill, it's very precise and very nice. This is the one the Bureau of Economic Geology uses. And if you go to the Bureau of Economic Geology website, you can look at this and you can see why there are little anomalies that jump up in different places. For example, if you're going to Austin and you go through the Lost Pines region, you wonder, how the heck did those pine trees get here in the middle of the prairie? Well, there's this uplift of land and blah, blah, blah. And it shows up on the map. But Dr. Lauren Kennemer, who was one of the foremost geographers of the state of Texas, simplified it a little bit. And this comes from the Atlas of Texas. And these are the regions that I would like you to know. Now, the good news is you can use your map. Well, you've got to be, but you won't need to if you've really studied it. So when somebody talks about the Piney Woods or the coastal prairie or the post oak, well, now, from the last time around when we did the pictures of Texas, what do you remember about the way those belts go? Piney Woods, what do you know about? Vegetation is always influenced by three main factors. Factor one is rainfall, right? Factor two?
Elevation.
Well, elevation's two as well. I mean, is in there, but it's probably not the most dominant form.
Climate.
Rain.
Climate. Soil.
Soil. Yeah. East Texas has several microclimes, and if you looked at that Bureau of Economic Geology, it shows you some of the microclimes within East Texas. And those are basically, the rainfall is about the same, but the soil type's different. Pine trees have got to have sandy soil, well-drained sandy soil. They can't live in heavy clay soil. There used to be a radio program on KTRH before it sold out and became a talk radio station called Garden Line with a guy by the name of Dewey Compton. And that was just about the time they started building subdivisions in the western part of Houston. And people would call in, my pine trees just don't look real good. They just withered down and die. And for the umpteenth thousand time, Dewey Compton would explain, you're in an area that has a heavy clay-based soil, and pine trees don't do well there. Plant oaks are trees that can live in a heavy clay-based soil. Or other people would call in, well, I put some pretty oak trees in my front yard, and they just aren't doing worth a darn. So, well, you live in the northeast sector up there, and that northeast sector has kind of a sandy, highly drained soil, and oak trees just can't survive in that. You get all these microclimates even within the coastal prairie. Third thing, of course, is either elevation or what substitutes for elevation, latitude. The further north you go, the colder the winters are going to be, right? I have a very, very good friend who moved to Dallas. And he had some of the most gorgeous hibiscus here in Galveston you have ever seen. And he transplanted a bunch of hibiscus to go up to his garden yard in Dallas. Tell me what happened. What happened?
They died. They withered and died.
Can they tolerate freezing temperatures? How often do we get freezing temperatures in Dallas?
Every winter.
Every winter. I told him the only way you can have those hibiscus is if you put them in a big pot and haul them in every time. They predict that the weather is going to freeze, and that means you're going to be hauling in about 5 or 10 times every winter in Dallas. And that's only about, what, 300 miles away. You get the same situation when you go up in elevation, right? That's why there used to be glaciers on those mountains in Colorado. So as we go from east to west, we're going to find several things change. One thing that changes is the rainfall rate. The second thing that changes will be the soil typologies. And the third thing is going to be the elevation. A triple whammy, right? All three. Now, I'm not going to sit here and ask you to memorize each and every one of those, because we've been there, done that, haven't we? What are some of the major features in Texas? Well, from 20,000 feet or 35,000 feet, you can see the Balcones Escarpment. It runs from basically around Del Rio on up to just south of Dallas. Now, it's there even when you get to Dallas. The only difference is it was a hinge type displacement. Now everybody watch what I'm doing. The area up around Dallas didn't move that much. The area down near San Antonio moved a great deal more. Got it? And you only see about half of the displacement today. For what reason? Several million years have eroded it. So a lot of what was in the hill country is now down on the coastal prairie, or down on the coastal plains. Fair enough? The Spanish word for balcony is balcones. And when the early Spanish settlers came in and looked at it, they said, you know, that looks like balconies across there. And so they called it the Balcones Escarpment, wall, the balconied wall. Now, the Caprock Escarpment is a different animal. I showed you a picture of that. You can go back and review it. It's on there. It is totally erosional. When you check the substrata, they're relatively at the same position under the ground. It's a major difference in erosion. Why do we call it the Cap Rock? Why is the area underlying the high plains known as the Cap Rock? What's your best guess? It's a thick bed of dolomitic limestone, which serves almost as a cap to protect it from erosion, to protect it from change. Easy? Yeah. Is that going to make it easy for the water to sink down? If there was a lot of rain, which there isn't, what is the chances that it would recharge the aquifers quickly and easily? No. We'll come back to that. Now, there's a lot of different mountains in the Mountain and Basin region of Texas. There's only three that I'm asking you to be familiar with, and they're primarily because A, they're the most significant, and B, there's some political stuff involved with them. The Guadalupes almost missed being in Texas when the people who drew the treaty line, hey Kathy, we're glad to have you, if the people who drew the treaty line had drawn the line 15 miles further south, the Guadalupe Mountains would have been entirely in New Mexico. Anybody in here ever gone to Carlsbad Caverns? Okay. When I was about 10, 11, something like that, my folks took us, I told you we traveled a lot, to Carlsbad. And I just knew that my father was playing a trick on us because we, okay, what do you remember about Carlsbad?
Which part?
Do you kind of go up and up and up and up a canyon before you get to the entrance to Carlsbad Caverns?
No, you have a little ways to go before.
Yeah, and I kept thinking, we're driving up, up, up. This is supposed to be a hole in the ground.
And then once you get
up, and we're going up, up, up. Well, of course, it's a hole in the ground, all right. But it's a hole in the ground in the mountain that you're climbing. The Davis Mountains are a totally different breed of cat. They are of igneous origin, volcanic origin. Volcanic basaltic outflows in the Davis Mountains. One of the things that was on my bucket list, and I'm afraid that I might kick the bucket if I attempted to do it now, is the Fort Davis Loop. There's a beautiful 87-mile loop within the Davis Mountains that I'm told is an absolute wonderful bicycle, but challenging route. Then there's the Chisos. The Apache word for ghost was Chisos. The Ghost Mountains, the Big Bend region is located there. Now let's talk about barrier islands. That's a subject that I'm sure most of you can probably identify with remotely. There's almost a funny story here, and I still tell it even though it's about 30 plus years old, maybe almost 40 years old. When I first started discussing the geography, I talked about Galveston being an island. Now you may not believe this, but 40 years or so ago, I had a lot of students who had almost never been off the island, period. And so I started talking about Galveston Island, and I had a young lady who was sitting about where you are, and she started getting pale. I said, what's the matter? We're on an island? Yeah. We're surrounded by water? Yeah. How do you get on or off? Well, you've got the causeway. At the time, San Luis Bridge had just been open, or the ferry. What if they're, you can't use them? I guess you could swim. I don't swim well. It's all right. It's only 4 miles or so over there. And besides, the sharks might get you. You mean there's sharks in the water? It had never occurred to her that there are sharks out there. I thought I was going to have to call 911. She was hyperventilating. Just relax. The sharks don't come on land. They're not going to bite you. The causeway, we've never had access problems with the causeway since the 1900 storm. Everybody's comfortable with the fact that we live on an island, Galveston Island, Barrier Island. Are there any issues associated with Barrier Islands? Do I need to reference Hurricane Ike on that? Did anybody read yesterday's paper where a group of scientists at Rice University have come up with a three-pronged plan to try to protect Galveston Bay and Houston? If not, I'll tell you what, I'll try to download it and post it. Fair enough? Everybody heard of the Ike Dike proposal to try to protect? Hello? How many of you have heard of the Ike Dike? No? It's a proposal that was put together by Bill Merrill over at Texas A&M University Galveston to protect both Galveston Island and the petrochemical industry located in the upper reaches of the bay. Now, as you move on down the coast, you get to Matagorda Peninsula and Matagorda Island. I did leave out Bolivar Peninsula. What's the difference between a peninsula and an island?
Peninsula, three sides of it is.
Yep, an island is completely surrounded by water. A peninsula is at least connected to the mainland. Now, technically, you have Bolivar Peninsula and Bolivar Island. Por qué? Remember Rollover Pass? Rollover Pass cuts the western section completely off from the eastern section. Matagorda Island, Matagorda Peninsula, and then there's the Mustang-St. Joseph Complex. Now, that's not really just one island, and it's not ever going to be heavily settled for a very simple reason. It's low-lying, insurance risks are incredible. And then you have Padre Island. About the central two-thirds of Padre Island are national seashore. Northern and southern ends have undergone rather substantial development with no seawall. Now, it's not a question of whether that area is going to suffer major damage when there's a big hurricane. It's just when it's going to occur. But fortunately, the big hurricanes tend not to hit down there. But they have in recorded history. Now, this only states the obvious. It rains a lot more in East Texas than it does in West Texas. Why are these two areas in yellow? That indicates they got more rainfall.
Because they're lower in the altitude.
No, go the other way.
They're higher in the altitude.
What's there? Davis Mountains and the Guadalupe Mountains, right? Not Guadalupe. Actually, the Guadalupes are there too. You can just see a little bit of the Guadalupe. But the Chisos. When the moist air coming off of the lower California, the Gulf of Baja, hits the mountains, that tends to rise. Now, you may remember when I showed you the real fast slideshow of Texas, when we were looking at the Big Bend region, there were all those really nice trees, Douglas firs, as a matter of fact. And we flipped through it so fast that you didn't have a chance to say, wait a minute, we're in the middle of a desert, and all of a sudden, where'd those Douglas firs come from? Well, guess what? You get a whole lot more rain up there in the Chisos Mountains or in the Davis Mountains. About the Guadalupe Mountains, not so much in the Guadalupes because they're too far inland. After we've done this particular thing on the physiography of Texas, just go back through and look at the slides and see if you can put some of that together with what we're talking about. Fair enough? Makes it fun. Don't grow much rice here on the high plains, do we? Pretty good reason for that. Now, Texas is blessed with a lot of rivers, but cursed by the fact that none of them are really big rivers. There's nothing comparable to the Ohio, Mississippi, Missouri. In the early settlement of Texas, how significant was river transportation? No. Texas possesses virtually no really navigable rivers. For a short period of time, they attempted to run steamboats up the Brazos River to Waco. It wasn't particularly successful. River was dry most of the summer and flooded during the winter, and there were lots of snags that usually tore the bottom out of the steamboats, so that didn't work. So what we're going to discover when we look at the socioeconomic development of Texas next week is that a lot of that had to wait for the railroads. Whereas in the eastern part of the United States, a lot of industrial and commercial development took place as a result of river traffic down the Missouri, the Ohio, the Mississippi. Didn't happen here. One of the things, frankly, that the Lewis and Clark expedition was attempting to discover was how easy it was going to be to settle all of that land that we had purchased with the Louisiana Purchase by going up the Missouri River. It turned out, until the steamboats came along, not real easy. What would you guess about the river flow in the eastern part of the state? Going to be pretty good, right? But there aren't many really big rivers in East Texas. There are a lot of relatively small rivers. We don't start getting any long rivers till we get to the Brazos, the Colorado, Guadalupe, and the Red River. Excuse me, not the Red River, the Rio Grande. And we know that the headwaters of the rivers in Texas are really in an area that don't get a whole lot of rain, right? Okay, I want to stop. I'm going to emphasize this several different times. The biggest single factor which may limit Texas' future growth will be the availability of water. I'll just beat that into your head. We are like California, living on the edge. And things were getting pretty serious with that drought. Did you hear on the radio this morning? Never mind, forget that. That Texas, still half of Texas, is rated as abnormally dry. Mm-hmm. We have not yet broken the drought. Now, it is possible that El Nino may break the drought this winter. But we don't have really major storage facilities, do we? We'll play with that. Now, I'm not going to spend half my life working through all of these rivers. Fair enough? Let's just talk about the biggies. Starting from west, anybody ever lived in or gone to Austin? There are some streets there named after rivers, aren't there? Do you know the order of the streets?
Not too well.
The westernmost river named street is Rio Grande. And then when we go a little bit further east to that, Pecos. Oh gee, you mean when they laid the streets out, they used exactly the same order that the rivers go in? So if you know the streets of Austin, you know the rivers. Now we skipped a few of them. There's no Canadian.
Yeah.
The last one is Sabine. No, Red River. Red River. Mm-hmm. But look, Red River, Nueces, San Antonio, Guadalupe, Colorado, Brazos, San Jacinto, Trinity, Neches, Sabine, no sulfur, Red River. Did you ever know that before?
No.
It clicks now, doesn't
yeah.
it? Yeah. Yeah. The Canadian's just kind of a wandering stranger passing through. What would you guess about the overall flow of the Canadian River? Not real big, right? Because you're going through basically semi-arid countryside. Now there's only one naturally occurring lake in Texas of greater than 10 acres in size. Everything else here is man-made. That's Caddo Lake. Anybody ever been up near Marshall, Texas to see Caddo Lake? Beautiful. Great cypress trees. But there's a problem right now with Caddo Lake, and that is with the growth of population in northeastern Texas, they've been consuming the water that would normally keep Caddo Lake full, and in the recent drought, it's been a problem. The good news is they've had a lot of rain recently. The bad news is it's not a big lake. It's not going to store it forever. If this were, of course, in Texas economics or whatever, I could probably spend about 15 or 20 minutes discussing the ecological, economic, and social impact of lakes building lakes. It's not a neutral thing. Yes, there are advantages to having lakes, but you destroy bottomland. You destroy a lot of the natural habitat that's necessary for certain plants and animals to live in. Now, here's the bad news. When the politicians talk about, well, we'll solve the water problems of Texas by building some more lakes, any politician that tries to sell you that particular line, you need to be in a position to look them in the face and say, are you aware that 90% of the economically and ecologically feasible dam sites in Texas have already been built out? If you want to double the water supply of the state of Texas, there is only one, the effective water supply for the state of Texas, there is only one way it can be achieved. Well, two ways it can be achieved. Well, it's really one way. Conservation. We ain't going to create more water, and we ain't going to store, even if we have a really wet year, much more than we currently store. Now, that is not a liberal, that is not a conservative, that is just a fact of life, Tonto. End of sentence. And by the way, it's not a matter of liberal politicians or conservative politicians that buy into that particular argument. It's ignorant politicians that buy into that line of argument, or politicians who think you're ignorant. Now, what is the major, we'll look at this Wednesday, what is the major, besides municipal water systems, the major other use of water in Texas? There are three main uses of water in Texas: municipal, industrial, and agricultural. Which one is most likely to get the knife?
Agricultural.
And has been, in fact, getting the knife. Okay, let's turn attention to California. California is in the midst of a record drought. What are they having to do? Seriously cut back on agricultural use, right? What is the third largest major source of income for California? Agriculture from the Central Valley. So it's tough decisions. Now, California's got an advantage we don't have. They get most of their rainfall, or most of their moisture, where? You know, of course, Los Angeles is essentially located in a desert. So where does the water, where does the moisture, Ms. Sargent? You feel comfortable with that question?
No, sir.
Okay. Anybody? What lies to the west in California?
The Pacific.
To the east. I've got that wrong. To the east. If you go east anywhere in California, what are you going to run into?
Mountains.
And what did we say happens when moisture hits mountains? You get rain or snow. Google snowpack California mountains. What are you going to find?
Snow on top of mountains.
Yeah, but they keep very careful measurement of the snowpack. All of the water that San Francisco, San Diego, Los Angeles uses comes from the snowpack in the mountains of Colorado that comes down through the rivers. Now, they got an advantage. It's rain, that's where their moisture is, but it's uphill. We got a disadvantage. All of our moisture is downhill. Now, let me ask you a question. This is going to sound like a dumb question, okay?
Okay.
How heavy is water?
Heavy.
Now, that's a real reasonable question, isn't
heavy.
It?
It's heavy.
Give me a figure. How much does a gallon of milk, which is 99% water?
About 5 pounds, give or take. Maybe
8 pounds.
A gallon of milk is 8 pounds?
Gallon of water weighs right at 8 pounds.
Really?
Yes.
I guess.
So if you're going to pump several million gallons of water uphill,
you're looking about 8 million at least.
Can we calculate how much energy it's going to take to move X number of gallons of water?
A lot.
X number of feet up? Back in the early 1960s, a group of not particularly intelligent politicians came up with this Texas water plan. We were going to build a bunch of reservoirs in East Texas and pump the water to the high plains. Fortunately, that got shot down. Voters had to vote on it, spend several billion dollars to try to do it. When you pointed out that there was not enough electrical generating capacity in the state of Texas to do that, and it would require building about three times as much electrical generating capacity as we currently had, and that the cost of the water delivered was such that the crops that you grew with it couldn't be sold, it would be too expensive. Fair enough? We'll play with that. Does everybody begin to understand why I put this unit in the course? When you start talking about the economic, social development of Texas, which is involved with politics as well, if you don't understand the basic facts of life about this sort of thing, you're wandering around in the desert. Pardon the pun. I think probably if I were in charge of orienting members of the Texas legislature, the first thing I would do is sit them down and make them take a good course in Texas geography, socio-demographics, stuff I cover the first 2 weeks. We talked about aquifers. I asked a question on a test one time, what is an aquifer? And one of the young ladies in my class put, is that the skin of a beaver? I laughed so hard I almost split a gut. She was serious. What's an aquifer? Yes, sir. They need to hear you too.
It's like an underground.
It's an underground
natural spring of
structure.
Water
that, no, springs can occur from aquifers.
Right.
It's an underground formation that holds water.
I've been to one in San Antonio before.
You're sitting on one right now. It's called a coastal aquifer, or set of coastal aquifers. There are three of them that I'm asking you to really know about because there's economic and political issues involved with all three. They're not the only three in Texas, as you can tell. This is the major aquifers. There are also some minor aquifers as well. The coastal aquifers. Now let's talk about typologies of aquifers, and I'm not going to put this on a test. It's just something that's good for you to know. Aquifers can be classified into two major big categories, open and closed aquifers. Open aquifer means exactly what it sounds like it is. Water goes in through the recharge zone and goes out through the discharge zone. You mentioned a spring, right?
Right.
What is a spring? A naturally occurring discharge region for an aquifer. The Edwards Limestone Aquifer is a very small but important aquifer, and there are a number of really great springs that emerge from it. Barton Springs, San Marcos Springs, San Pedro Springs, which used to occur in San Antonio before they pumped the water level down to where it couldn't come out. And the Ogallala. Now the Ogallala is a closed aquifer. What do you think that means?
There's only one.
Basically, it's a big bowl. The water in a closed aquifer is essentially fossil water left over from a previous recharge zone, recharge period. Now you're a smart young fellow. I can tell by looking at you. If you have a tank into which only a little bit of water can dribble periodically, and you put a pump down in there and you start pumping it, what ultimately is going to occur?
The water that's in it.
Right, it's going to run dry. You see those pictures, remember that pictures that I showed you of these big sprinklers that they use in the high plains to produce crops? They're pumping the Ogallala Formation. And if you Google or look at water levels in the Ogallala Formation, which by the way extends all the way on up to Kansas, over the last 20, 30 years, what do you think you're going to find?
Yeah, drop.
It's constantly dropping. Now earlier, we talked a little bit about the fact that water is heavy, right? And it takes energy to pump it up. So if you're having to pump it from 500 feet down rather than 200 feet down, what do you think is going to happen to the cost, delivered cost to that water?
It's going to go up.
Are the price of the crops that you're growing necessarily going to grow up equal to that? Not unless you're growing something like corn from Olathe where you can, you know, jack the price up. If it's cotton, you're in trouble. So when we talk about economics of the High Plains, if you knew that the major single source of income for the High Plains was irrigated agriculture dependent upon the Ogallala Formation, what conclusions could you draw? Is it going to be an area of the state where the population is going to be rapidly increasing or declining?
Declining.
And it's an economic issue, isn't it? See how we're tying all this together with politics? And if the population declines, it's going to have less impact. Aging professor trips over her own feet. Cities. Now, I am not about to sit here and ask you to memorize every city in the state of Texas. You can look them up. But I'll bet most of you could tell me what the big cities of Texas are. Notice that better than 80% of all the population of the state of Texas live east of the Balcones Escarpment. Now, let me ask you a question. If I had made that statement an hour ago, would it have made any sense to you? Does it now? You know where the Balcones Escarpment is? Yeah. See? It's tying the pieces together. What is the combined population of the Houston-Galveston Metroplex, the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, and its suburbs? Just give me a guess.
4 million.
Houston alone is close to 5 million.
Aren't they like 4.5 million?
No. We're coming up on 8, 9, 10 million people. Now, the other population belt, and we'll look at this Wednesday, the other population belt runs from basically along I-35. Everybody knows where I-35 is?
Yeah.
San Antonio,
Austin area.
Right up through Dallas. We ran real fast past this, but you remember where the Blackland Prairie is? If the Blackland Prairie was a state, not just a geographic region in Texas, but if the Blackland Prairie was a state, it would be among the 10 largest, most heavily populated states in the Union. Does that register? What's the population of Texas, by the way? Anybody want to guess?
23 million.
Say again?
23 million.
Very close. Very close. 24 point something. But that's a good ballpark. Probably right at the present time, close to 25 million. How many other states are anywhere close to that?
California.
California's number one.
New York, probably.
New York is number four. Texas is number two. Florida is number three. New York. The combined populations of those four states are close to 30% of the population of the United States. If we break them down by region, what's the only really, what are the major cities east of the Balcones Escarpment? Well, obviously Houston, Galveston, Metroplex, Dallas-Fort Worth, Austin, San Antonio, and increasingly this is getting to be almost a solid belt of population from San Antonio to Dallas. I don't know that I'll live long enough to see it a continuous metroplex, but you probably will. assuming the economy of Texas continues to grow. And what's going to be the big issue there? Yes, hold it up. Water. Thank you. When we get over to West Texas, we're really not talking big cities. West of the Balcones Escarpment, the biggest city out there is El Paso. The rest of them are nice dots. They're nice places to be, but they ain't big. And they're not likely to ever be big because of the underlying economics, which we're going to look at Wednesday, okay?